Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. State budget discussions have again broken down, with the powerful Joint Finance Committee announcing a pause as deadlines loom. Plus, lawmakers in Wisconsin respond to the weekend's deadly attacks on their Minnesota counterparts. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court hands a unanimous victory to Attorney General Josh Call about approving legal settlements. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 20th.
Hi, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
Hi, I'm Jesse Opoyan.
Welcome to another episode of Rewind. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Anya.
We are going to get started with the budget. It was quite a week this week. It started out pretty normal. Tuesday was kind of a normal day at the budget. We took up corrections budget, public service commission, a bunch of prosecutors got funded, and we saw kind of the usual breakdown, I think, of Governor Evers asked for a certain amount, Republicans gave back a little bit less, but they funded 42 prosecutor positions in 23 counties, talked about ARPA funds, expiring federal funds. So we get into Thursday, and we are kind of ready for a potentially long night. We see some big ticket items on that agenda, and then we go into the day, and instead we get this statement that's now on the screen from Devin LeMahieu, saying these discussions are headed in a direction that taxpayers can afford. Senate Republicans are ready to work with the state assembly to pass a balanced budget that cuts taxes and responsibly invests in core priorities. So we learned that talks have started back up and broken down. And a little bit later, Democrats from the Joint Finance held a press conference, and Representative Tip McGuire being one of them. He says, weeks ago, legislative Republicans walked away from negotiating with the governor in order to attempt to pass this budget by again giving into the desires of the most extreme members of their legislative caucuses, and instead they find themselves here again, unable or struggling to pass a budget. So that's a lot of information that gets thrown at us all at once. We're trying to understand sort of what this breakdown is, but this is all kind of coming as we are hearing that potentially two Senate Republicans are not going to sign on to the budget that's being crafted by their party members, and we now have a narrow enough majority. Republicans have a narrow enough majority that if they lose two votes, there goes their budget. And so that sort of seems to be the breakdown. We then get a statement from Robin Voss saying Senate Republicans are welcome to come back to the table. So there seems to be a little bit of blame there. And so we've got these three kind of parties going on. But what do you understand to be kind of the sticking point in those negotiations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole new ballgame just in the fact that Republican legislative leaders have been, you know, sitting down with the Democratic governor, that the three, you know, sort of parties of all of this have actually been able to even get to the point where they could have those conversations, right? And they've tried it a few times. They tried it again. It seemed like maybe they're getting somewhere. And it falls apart effectively. You know, if you read into Speaker Robin Voss's statement a little bit, he's kind of communicating that, you know, Assembly Republicans feel that the only way really to get what they want, to get some of what they want, especially in tax cuts, is to work with the governor and have some sort of guarantee that they can pass a budget that has assurances that he's going to sign their tax priorities into law. And if you look at the last time negotiations fell apart, the governor indicated that he's willing to meet Republicans, you know, where they're looking on taxes. The problem then comes when we look at education funding, university funding. You know, there was this number floating around throughout the week, an $87 million cut to the UW system. Assembly Republicans said they're on board with that. The governor says, absolutely not, it's a non-starter.
And he's then requesting $850 million increase, and they're saying, no, we're going to cut
it. Yep. And then you go to the Senate, and you see, you know, someone like Senator Steve Noss, who's very likely a no on the budget, saying, I want an even bigger cut. So, it, you know, yesterday, it very much felt like you had the Assembly and the governor looking to the Senate to say, you know, you come back to the table. Senate Democrats, when they talked to reporters, same thing. They said Senate Republicans need to pick up the phone. But then, of course, Senate Republicans say, no, we're willing to work. Like, we just can't spend that much money.
Yeah, and it kind of does echo what's going on at the federal level. I think Senator Kelda Roy said that yesterday when the Democrats gave their press conference, that a few people are able to kind of hold up negotiations, and so there's a little bit of a values discussion going on clearly within the caucuses. The Democrats frame that as extremists, I believe that they called it, although they declined to name which lawmakers they were kind of pointing fingers at. But that's kind of an interesting, as Representative McGuire said in that statement, he seems to be saying that Republicans are kind of backing themselves into a corner. And so
it's bit of a throwback, too. If you were here in 2017, that budget, there's a little bit of a dust up. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss referred to terrorists holding up the budget. And it was, I think, three Republican senators who were able to negotiate with the governor to get the vetoes that they wanted in the budget before they were able to pass it. And so we're hearing, you know, extremists, terrorists, like we're hearing a lot of the same things. And once again, it's coming back to the Senate Republican caucus.
Yeah. And so we'll kind of see when this does resume, if it does. But we did also have a little bit of business as usual on the floor this week. So both the Assembly and the Senate were in session this week, and they got quite a bit done. They passed some standalone bills. Two that I'll highlight. One in the Assembly created a new penalty on what is called sexual extortion cases. And in the Senate, there was a new penalties put on property damages during protest or riot activities. So those are two standalone bills. And then the chambers also sort of simultaneously passed two bills that will now be headed to the governor. One would create portable benefit accounts for gig drivers, people who work for things like DoorDash, Uber, and another that would create a sort of advanced license for a certain quality of nurses. So let's kind of get into those bills a little bit. The sextortion bill, I think, is really interesting because it is inspired here in Wisconsin by a really tragic case of a young man who was victim to this type of scam. So this is when generally adults sort of pose as children and try to entice them on the internet, get, you know, intimate photos or imagery, and then blackmail them. And so this is according to the FBI, significantly on the rise. And here in Wisconsin, there is a case of a young man who whose family says he died by suicide as a result of this happening to him. And so this would both create a felony penalty for that type of scam and then also potentially lead to a person getting charged with murder if their action contributes to a person's suicide. So that was in the Assembly. Over in the Senate, this came out of the 2020 protests. It would impose stricter penalties for people who cause injuries or property damage during riots. The first bill that I mentioned was very much bipartisan. This one very much was not. This is a Republican-led bill. Democrats argued that this criminalizes protests, criminalizes free speech. Republicans say there needs to be consequences for creating damage in communities. So those were those standalone bills. And then we also have the two bills that will be headed to the governor that come out of years of debate in both cases. The first one, that portable benefit accounts for gig drivers, that would create these funds that gig workers could draw from for things like healthcare, paid leave, retirement. What's really interesting there is that, you know, there's been this longstanding debate about how we classify gig workers. Are they employees? Are they independent contractors? And in certain states, there have been lawsuits by gig workers saying, you know, I work full time, I receive benefits, I therefore should be classified as an employee. And so what this bill does, it establishes a voluntary program that gig drivers can participate in. But by participating, they are automatically classified as independent contractors. And so it kind of is a way around the potential for those kinds of lawsuits. We have some video of the floor debate, this kind of breakdown of how our lawmakers think about this issue.
Under this bill, app-based drivers, those who deliver our food, drive us home safely at night, and keep the gig economy running, would be denied recognition as employees. That means no guaranteed minimum wage, no unemployment insurance, no workers' compensation if they're hurt on the job. And let me remind you, these are essential workers. They kept our economy moving through a global pandemic. And now, instead of giving them a seat at the table, we're being asked to strip away their rights and their voice in the workplace.
90% of the drivers for these companies want their independent contractor status. They don't want to be told when and where to work, how to work, how many trips they have to take. They want their independent status. This is for the independent contractor and the freedom that they have to get ahead in life by working a couple extra jobs, a couple extra trips on a weekend to make a little bit of extra cash, while at the same time voluntarily partnering with one of these companies to provide to pay for their benefits, to pay for their retirement. Again, the opportunity for workers to make choices on their own to get ahead in life.
So that kind of breaks down, you know, the debate that we saw on the floor, Democrats really saying that this doesn't do enough to support gig workers, that they are essential, that they work really hard, that they need basic sort of labor standards. And then Dahlman's point, and I think this is interesting, I don't know if he brought it up on the floor this week, but in past testimony, he has said he himself has been an Uber driver. And so he's talked about the need for that flexibility, that it allows workers to pick up shifts when they want to work for multiple competing companies. And so what this rule does is kind of enshrine that flexibility while also offering, you know, benefits that certain full-time employees do have access to. And then the other bill that we are going to see heading towards the governor's desk is about a new standard for nursing. Can you tell me about what that is?
Yeah, this bill has been, I think, a decade plus in the making, and it saw a lot of revived interest during and after COVID. So during COVID, advanced nurses were able to practice a lot more independently than they had been under, you know, under the existing law. This basically allows nurses to practice to the full extent of the education and training that they have, with you know, some guardrails in check to, you know, make sure that safety is still in place. The hang-ups on this bill over the years have been things like how many hours do advanced practice nurses need to work under the supervision or collaboration with a physician or a dentist? How do they handle pain management? How do we protect titles for doctors, you know, you don't have someone who's not a doctor calling themselves a doctor, just things like that. And it's just been really kind of like fine tuning over the last few iterations of this, and it's gotten close and just not made it the last few times. So everyone who worked on this bill was very excited about it. It's bipartisan. The governor has said that, you know, this one, it meets the criteria that he has set out before. And so he's going to sign it when it gets to his desk. And I think it's definitely a compromise bill. I don't think everyone is 100% happy with it, but it's close enough to, you know, what everyone can agree on. And so they finally got this one past the finish line.
Yeah, so bipartisan accord there, although accord was not really the tone, I would say, overall, especially on the Senate floor this week. There was really a kind of back and forth about this idea of ruined trust. So Republicans were bringing forward a number of bills that did not have funding attached to them. And what they were saying is that's essentially a way of avoiding Governor Evers' new 400-year veto pen. So because he enacted that 400-year education funding veto, they now say we can't trust him with numbers, we can't trust him with dollars, and so they want to pass these kind of unfunded bills. And then Democrats say, well, then you're passing unfunded mandates, and so then you can really kind of mess up the policy that you say that you want to support. Senator Jeff Smith was talking about, you know, we trusted you to pass, to release funding on past projects, and he argued that that actually has led to hospitals closing in the Chippewa Valley. So again, we have some video of that back and forth.
Last year, two hospitals closed, major hospitals closed in the Chippewa Valley. And we're still waiting for that $15 million that was promised to the Chippewa Valley. That trust has been broken, so you cannot expect me to pity the other side when I know there are of the suffering that has happened with people in the Chippewa Valley in western Wisconsin because that trust was broken. This is your last chance, maybe, to repair that trust with this by voting no on rejection on this amendment, so that we are not sending a bill to the public without at least letting them know that it is not law if it is not funded.
The governor literally says, change this so I can line item veto your bill. Write in the letter. Please allow me to exercise my constitutional authority to line item veto your bill. He's asking us to allow him to tinker with our legislation. And so I don't know why we want to open the door to allow the governor to do our job, potentially strike out all the language and take our money, or to continue to allow this game to go on. So again, the reason the Chippewa Valley has no hospital money is because of Governor Evers' veto. The reason there's no PFAS money is because of Governor Evers' line item veto. And the reason there's no literacy money, which we've heard about again today, is because Governor Evers' line item veto. And today, the Senate has had enough, And we're saying no.
Yeah, so trust in kind of short supply over at the Capitol. Although, this kind of gets us into our next topic, which is obviously the tragedy in Minnesota over the weekend. You've been covering the Capitol longer than I have, but in the time that I've been covering it, I have never received a joint statement from all four leaders of the Capitol. We received one of those over the weekend in response to those assassinations. The horrific attacks against Minnesota Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and Senator John Hoffman appear to be targeted acts of political violence. No one should ever fear for their lives because of their service to their community. Political violence accomplishes nothing and is never the answer. We hope that the assailant is apprehended swiftly. So that came out, you know, very shortly after the news of the assassinations from Senate Majority Leader, Senate Minority Leader, Assembly Speaker, Assembly Minority Leader. And there was, you know, aspects of this that hit close to home. It has been reported that at least 11 Wisconsin lawmakers were on the alleged hit list that the person who's been apprehended had. And so there's been a lot of conversation at the Capitol about sort of how lawmakers can stay safe in the face of what we understand to be kind of increased threats generally. We have a video of some lawmakers talking about this.
Political violence has no place in our democracy. In fact, it strikes at the very heart of our democratic system. We settle differences with debate, conversation, and ultimately the ballot box, not at the point of a gun. No one should fear for their lives because of their service to the community or because of their involvement in public life.
Whenever an incident like this happens, the most important thing that we can do is to take a breath and look at what's going to be the actual best potential solution as opposed to a knee-jerk reaction. The thing that's most scary is this didn't occur in a Capitol. It occurred at someone's home. So the idea of trying to make the Capitol into a fortress, I don't know if that necessarily would even have ever done anything in this situation to help the awful situation that happened in Minnesota.
Yeah, so some unity there about how lawmakers obviously feel in response to this, but some debate over how to respond. So at least one Republican lawmaker has called for metal detectors. We just heard Speaker Voss say, you know, we don't want to turn the Capitol into a fortress as a response. Democrats are not commenting on kind of specific measures. They are citing security concerns for that reason. But here is what has happened in the last week. As of Monday, the Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms has implemented updated measures, increased situational awareness practices, strengthened access control points, updated emergency response protocols. I don't know if this is just anecdotal, but I feel like I've seen more Capitol Police around this week. You know, it's been really interesting, that kind of mix of emotional and practical concerns. Speaker Voss gave quite emotional comments before the Assembly convened on Wednesday, talking about his personal relationship with Hortman. And leaders say they're just talking with their caucuses about how to feel safe. There's some proposed legislation, but it is, as Speaker Voss mentioned, when people are targeted in their homes, there's a little bit of a difference between thinking about how to also be safe in public spaces like the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tricky things to consider here, and it has come up before. You know, our Capitol is accessible to the public, and we like it that way. You know, it's the people's house.
Right? Uh-huh.
Exactly. And that's real, and that's true. And, you know, you don't want to give the impression that it's locked away and that it's only for the people who work there, you know, important people. Like, it's for everyone. You know, that being said, you do have to consider safety. You do have to consider that, you know, rhetoric is more heated, that threats are on the rise, that things like this are happening, and that people, you know, are concerned about their safety. There's been talk about, there was legislation that was passed that would, you know, shield the addresses of judges from the public. There have been questions about should that be extended to state legislators. The counter to that being, state legislators are inherently really publicly accessible. You know, they go to parades. People do know where they live. People, you know, run into them at the grocery store. They know them, and you don't want to take away from that. So there's just a lot to balance here. Speaker Voss talked about not having a knee-jerk reaction, and I expect that that'll be the case. I think this is going to be an ongoing conversation. It comes up anytime something frightening happens, something dangerous happens, but I think that, you know, because as you said, it just hit so close to home, you know, we'll probably see this conversation really continue. And, you know, multiple legislators that I talked to brought up social media and civility and rhetoric, and you know, we hear that thrown around a lot, but it's true, and it's members of both parties who are noticing just this increasing vitriol, people saying things that they would never, you know, say to anyone, to their face, and how that might potentially embolden people who are inclined to act, you know, violently when they see someone sort of dehumanized over and over again. And that's a harder conversation to have because you can't really legislate that.
That's right. Yeah, that's sort of the conversation I've had with lawmakers, is that unfortunately you become accustomed to a certain level of threats and comments on social media and things like that. But then to see somebody actually kind of take action, I think, has really made a number of the people that I've been speaking to kind of reassess, you know, how seriously to take those types of comments. Moving on to a very different topic, let's go to the Supreme Court,
yes.
Where on Tuesday, the famously divided Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of Democratic Attorney General Josh Call in a lawsuit about settling certain lawsuits. So Call sued...
Welcome to Wisconsin. We have lawsuits about lawsuits.
That's right. Meta lawsuits over here. So this is based on a practice that came out of the 2018 lame duck period that gave the legislature authority to kind of oversee DOJ settlements, especially on things like environmental settlements, consumer protection, anything involving the executive branch or governor's office. And so Call's lawsuit argued that this violates separation of powers, basically gives the legislature authority over the executive branch in a way it's not supposed to. A lawyer for the legislature argued in response that the legislature's job is to oversee taxpayer dollars, and so this is a way of doing that. But that was rejected by the Supreme Court. They found that that separation of powers argument stood. And so, you know, I'm talking about the legislature, but really I'm talking about the Joint Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting, you know, Call's response was, this will make that whole process kind of easier and quicker. And we saw the JFC chairs kind of downplay that reaction and say, things have been plenty quick and plenty efficient. You know, this shouldn't change much.
Yeah, you know, this is, we've seen most of the lame duck laws that were passed as Josh Call and Tony Evers were coming into office. We've seen most of those upheld when they've been challenged. And I think what was interesting about this was the first one to go before the court with a liberal majority, but that didn't matter because it was unanimous. And it's such a narrow concept. It's these very specific settlements of specific lawsuits that they were able to, I mean, it was an argument about, you know, core powers versus shared powers. So we're talking really in the weeds here, but it's still, I think, yeah, it's significant and always interesting when you get a unanimous decision out of that court.
Yeah, definitely. And that also means that we're gearing up for quite perhaps a flood of decisions coming out of this court kind of soon. Another sort of thing that took place this week is the Wisconsin Election Commission met. And speaking of things that have been many years in the making, they passed a new rule about election observers. That's been in the work for 2 years. It'll go into effect on July 1st. That sets new standards for election observers, sort of where they can and can't go, where what they can and can't record, and then also how to remove them if they do violate these standards. Also on July 1st, there will be a new election official privacy law that was passed by the legislature. So at this WEC meeting, they didn't do anything new with that. They just issued guidance about how to participate with that law. So what that does is essentially shields the personal information of certain election workers and officials from being eligible for records requests. That was part of a bipartisan push in the legislature over the last few years to protect election workers. While we've been talking about threats to lawmakers, you know, there's also been threats to judges, there's been threats to county and municipal clerks, the people who do administer the elections. And so a bipartisan group of lawmakers has worked on a number of proposals in response to that. This is one of the laws that was passed last session. And so WEC issued guidance on how to follow that law. It's just been really interesting, I think, to see how the fallout of 2020 continues to play out. It's been 5 years since that election and you know, COVID sort of mixing up everything. Mm-hmm. And we are still seeing the legislature, you know, legislate around that. So that's been really interesting. And then finally, there was a different kind of election that took place over the weekend at the Democratic State Convention. This sort of big ticket item was figuring out who was going to replace outgoing chair Ben Wickler. As you can see on this slide here, Ben Wickler left huge fundraising shoes to fill. So he announced his departure in April. And you can see that spike in fundraising numbers came when he took the helm of the party. And so this has been this kind of ongoing question. I remember, you know, at the Democratic National Convention last summer, just watching a string of Democratic leaders come through to pay their respects to Wisconsin's own Ben Wickler.
Yeah.
And so really he was like leaving these big shoes to fill. I was not at the convention. I was at a wedding over the weekend. So why don't you tell us what went down?
Sure. So I was actually not there either, but my coworkers were, and I was following along at home. So I'll try to do this. But Devin Remicker has been working with the party. I think he started off as its political director since 2018, and was active in campaigns in the state before that. So, you know, he was there for the Wickler era. You know, the two of them. He served as an executive director for a while. So that, you know, the two of them were working together. A lot of the, you know, I was reading through Ben Wickler's endorsement of Devin Remicker, and it was touting sort of a lot of the achievements that, you know, made news over time, more related to strategy, I suppose, than fundraising. He attributed a lot of those to Devin Remicker's work behind the scenes. So interesting to see someone kind of step out from that behind the scenes role into this much more public facing role. Will he, you know, be the sort of the face on the media like Ben Wickler was? Will he be a fundraising powerhouse? I was looking at this. It was under Wickler, $262 million brought in. And in the 5 years before that, $37 million. I mean, just, you know, blowing it out of the water. So, you know, I think we can expect sort of probably a familiar path for a little while here, but you know, it'll be his to make his own and continue that and see, you know, how we go.
Yeah, well, to your point, I mean, Wickler really kind of took over a party that was in many ways in need of transformation. They had this very kind of humiliating 2016 cycle, as the Democrats sort of never let you forget when you chat with them about that. Mm-hmm. And so you see the way that he kind of transformed this party. And so again, those are big shoes to fill. And so I guess the question too is, you know, will Remicker just continue that legacy or try to kind of carve something out on his own? An open question that I have as well is, you know, Wickler came from a D.C. background and so has some of those national contacts, and here comes a state party faithful. And so to what extent will he be able to make that kind of national splash? We will see, but that'll be really interesting to kind of follow, especially too as the Democrats continue to kind of reassess after their own November and kind of play those games out. Well, I think that about does it for Rewind for this week. I am Anyvan Wagtendonk.
I'm Jesse Opoyan.
And we will see you next week. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.